Ralph recounted the crash of the Carver family as clearly as he could, eating sardines between bursts of talk. He was trying to clear his head, trying to come back, for David's sake more than his own. But it was hard. He kept seeing Kirsty lying motionless at the foot of the stairs, kept seeing Antragian pulling Ellie across the holding area by the arm. "Don't worry, David, I'll be back," she had said, but to Ralph, who believed he had heard every turn and lift of Ellie's voice in their 14 years of marriage, she had sounded already gone. Still, he owed it to David to try and be here, to come back himself from wherever it was his shocked, overstressed, and guilty, yes, there was that too, mind wanted to take him. But it was hard. When he had finished, Audrey said, "Okay, no revolt from the animal kingdom, at least. But I'm very sorry about your wife and your little girl, Mr. Carver. You too, David." "Thanks," Ralph said, and when David added, "My mom could still be okay," he ruffled the boy's hair and told him, yes, that was right. Mary went next, telling about the baggie under the spare tire, the way Antragian had mixed, "I'm going to kill you," into the Miranda warning, and the way he had shot her husband on the steps, completely without warning or provocation. "Still no wildlife," Audrey said. This now seemed to be her central concern. She tilted her sardine can up to her mouth and drank the last of the fish oil without so much as a flicker of embarrassment. "You either didn't hear the part about the coyote he brought upstairs to guard us, or you don't want to hear it," Mary said. Audrey dismissed this with a wave of her hand. She was sitting down now, providing Billingsley with at least another 4 inches of leg to look at. Ralph was looking too, but he felt absolutely nothing about what he was seeing. He had an idea there was more juice in some old car batteries than there was in his emotional wiring right now. "You can domesticate them, you know," she said. "Feed them Gainsburgers and train them like dogs, in fact." "Did you ever see Antragian walking around town with a coyote on a leash?" Marinville asked politely. She gave him a look and set her jaw. "No, I knew him to speak to like anyone else in town, but that was all. I spend most of my time in the pit or the lab or out riding. I'm not much for town life." "What about you, Steve?" Marinville asked. "What's your tale?" Ralph saw the rangy fellow with the Texas accent exchange a glance with his girlfriend, if that was what she was, and then look back at the writer. "Well, first off, if you tell your agent I picked up a hitchhiker, I guess I'll lose my bonus." "I think you can consider him the least of your worries at this point. Go on, tell it." They both told it, alternating segments, both clearly aware that the things they had seen and experienced upped the ante of belief considerably. They both expressed frustration at their inability to articulate how awful the stone fragment in the lab storage area had been, how powerfully it had affected them, and neither seemed to want to come out and say what had happened when the wolf, they all agreed that was what it had been, not a coyote, brought the fragment out of the lab and laid it before them. Ralph had an idea it was something sexual, although what could be so bad about that, he didn't know. "Still a doubting Thomas?" Marinville asked Audrey when Steve and Cynthia had finished. He spoke mildly, as if he did not want her to feel threatened. "Of course he doesn't want her to feel threatened," Ralph thought. "There's only 7 of us. He wants us all on the same team, and he's really not too bad at it." "I don't know what I am." She sounded dazed. "I don't want to believe any of this shit. Just considering it freaks me severely. But I can't imagine why you'd lie." She paused, then said thoughtfully, "Unless seeing those people hung up in Hernando's hideaway, I don't know, scared you so badly that..." "That we started seeing things?" Steve asked. She nodded. "The snakes you saw in the house, that at least makes sense of a sort. They feel this kind of weather coming as much as 3 days in advance sometimes, and go for any sheltered place. As for the rest, I don't know. I'm a scientist, and I can't see how..." "Come on, lady, you're like a kid pretending her mouth is stitched shut so she won't have to eat the broccoli," Cynthia said. Everything we saw dovetails with what Mr. Merrinville there saw before us, and Mary saw before him, and the Carvers before them, right down to the knocked-over piece of picket fence where Entragian greased the barber, or whoever he was. So quit the I'm a scientist crap for a while. We're all on the same page. You're the one that's on a different one. But I didn't see any of those things, Audrey almost wailed. What did you see? Ralph asked. Tell us. Audrey crossed her legs, tugged at the hem of her dress. I was camping. I had 4 days off, so I packed up Sally and headed north into the Copper Range. It's my favorite place in Nevada. Ralph thought she looked defensive, as if she had taken a ribbing for this sort of behavior in the past. Billingsley looked as if he had just wakened from a dream, one of having Audrey's long legs wrapped around his scrawny old butt, perhaps. Sally, he said. How is Sally? Audrey gave him an uncomprehending look for a moment, then grinned like a girl. She's fine. Strain all better? Yes, thanks. It was good liniment. Glad to hear it. What are you talking about? Merrinville asked. I doctored her horse a year or so back, Billingsley said. That's all. Ralph wasn't sure he would let Billingsley work on his horse, if he had one. He wasn't sure he would let Billingsley work on a stray cat. But he supposed the vet might have been different a year ago. When you made drinking a career, 12 months could make a lot of changes. Few of them for the better. Getting Rattlesnake back on its feet has been pretty stressful, she said. Lately it's been the switch over from rainbirds to emitters. A few eagles died. A few, Billingsley said. Come now, I'm no tree hugger, but you can do better than that. All right, about 40 in all. No big deal in terms of the species. There's no shortage of eagles in Nevada, as you know, Doc. The Greens know it, too, but they treat each dead eagle as if it were a boiled baby just the same. What it's really about, and all it's about, is trying to stop us from mining the copper. God, they make me so tired sometimes. They come out here in their perky little foreign cars, 50 pounds of American copper in each one, and tell us we're earth-raping monsters. They... Ma'am, Steve said softly, pardon, but ain't a one of us folks from Greenpeace. Of course not. What I'm saying is that we all felt bad about the eagles, the hawks and the ravens too, for that matter, in spite of what the tree huggers say. She looked around at them, as if to evaluate their impression of her honesty, then went on. We leach copper out of the ground with sulfuric acid. The easiest way to apply it is with rainbirds. They look like big lawn sprinklers. But rainbirds can leave pools. The birds see them, come down to bathe and drink, then die. It's not a nice death, either. No, Billingsley agreed, blinking at her with his watery eyes. When it was gold they were taking out of China Pit and Desitoya Pit, back in the '50s, it was cyanide in the pools. Just as nasty. No greeny tree-huggers back then, though. Must have been nice for the company, eh, Miss Weiler? He got up, went to the bar, poured himself a finger of whiskey, and swallowed it like medicine. Could I have one about the same? Ralph asked. Yes, sir, I believe you could, Billingsley said. He handed Ralph his drink, then set out more glasses. He offered warm soft drinks, but the others opted for spring water, which he poured out of a plastic jug. We pulled the rainbirds and replaced them with distribution heads and emitters, Audrey said. It's a drip system, more expensive than the rainbirds, a lot, but the birds don't get into the chemicals. No, Billingsley agreed. He poured himself another tot. This he drank more slowly, looking at Audrey's legs again over the rim of his glass. 5. A problem? Maybe not yet, but there could be if steps weren't taken. The thing that looked like Ellen Carver sat behind the desk in the now empty holding area, head up, eyes gleaming lustrously. Outside, the wind rose and fell, rose and fell. From closer by came the pad click of paws ascending the stairs. They stopped outside the door. There came a coughing growl. Then the door swung open, pushed by the snout of a cougar. She was big for a female, perhaps 6 feet from snout to haunches, with a thick, switching tail that added another 3 feet to her overall length. As the cougar came through the door and into the holding area, slinking low to the board floor, her ears laid back against her wedge-shaped skull, the thing cored into her head a little further, wanting to experience a bit of what the cougar was feeling as well as to draw her. The animal was frightened, sorting through the smells of the place and finding no comfort in any of them. It was a human den place, but that was only part of her problem. The cougar smelled a lot of trouble here. Gunpowder, for one thing. To the cougar, the smell of the fired guns was still sharp and acrid. Then there was the smell of fear, like a mixture of sweat and burned grass. There was the smell of blood, too. Coyote blood and human blood mixed together. And there was the thing in the chair, looking down at her as she slunk toward it, not wanting to go, but not able to stop. It looked like a human being, but didn't smell like one. It didn't smell like anything the cougar had ever scented before. She crouched by its feet and voiced a low, whining, mewing sound. The thing in the coverall got out of the chair, dropped to Ellen Carver's knees, lifted the cougar's snout, and looked into the cougar's eyes. It began to speak rapidly in that other language, the tongue of the unformed, telling the cougar where she must go, how she must wait, and what she must do when the time came. They were armed and would likely kill the animal, but she would do her job first. As it spoke, Ellen's nose began to trickle blood. It felt the blood, wiped it away. Blisters had begun to rise on Ellen's cheeks and neck. Fucking yeast infection. Nothing more than that, at least to start with. Why was it some women simply could not take care of themselves? All right, it told the cougar. Go on now. Wait until it's time. I'll listen with you. The cougar made its whining, mewing sound again, licked with its rough tongue at the hand of the thing wearing Ellen Carver's body, then turned and padded out of the room. It resumed the chair and leaned back in it. It closed Ellen's eyes and listened to the ceaseless rattle of sand against the windows and let part of itself go with the animal. Chapter 2 1 You had some downtime coming. You saddled up and you went camping, Steve said. What then? I spent 4 days in the coppers, fishing, taking pictures. Photography's what I do for fun. Great days. Then, 3 nights ago, I came back, went right to my house, which is north of town. What brought you back? Steve asked. It wasn't bad weather on the way, was it? No, I had my little radio with me, and all I heard was fair and hot. All I heard, too, Steve said. This shit's a total mystery. I had a meeting scheduled with Alan Symes, the company controller, to summarize the switchover from rainbirds to heads and emitters. He was flying in from Arizona. I was supposed to meet him at Hernando's hideaway at 9 o'clock, the morning before last. That's what we'd taken to calling the lab and the offices out there on the edge of town. Anyway, that's why I'm wearing this damn dress, because of the meeting and because Frank Geller told me that Symes didn't. Like women in jeans. I know everything was okay when I got back from my camping trip, because that's when Frank called me and told me to wear a dress to the meeting, that night around 7.
Who's Frank Geller? Steve asked. Chief mining engineer, Billingsley said, in charge of reopening the China pit. At least he was.
He gave Audrey a questioning look. She nodded. Yes, he's dead.
3 nights ago, Marinville mused. Everything in desperation was peachy 3 nights ago, at least as far as you know.
That's right, but the next time I saw Frank, he was hung up on a hook, and one of his hands was gone. We saw him, Cynthia said, and shivered. We saw his hand, too, at the bottom of an aquarium. Before all that, during the night, I woke up at least twice. The first time I thought it was thunder, but the second time it sounded like gunshots. I decided I'd been dreaming and went back to sleep, but that must be around the time he got started. Then, when I got to the mining office... At first, she said, she hadn't sensed anything wrong, certainly not from the fact that Brad Josephson wasn't at his desk. Brad never was, if he could help it. So she had gone out back to Hernando's hideaway, and there she had seen what Steve and Cynthia would come along and see themselves not long after, bodies on hooks. Apparently, everyone who had come in that morning, one of them, dressed in a string tie and dress boots that would have tickled a country and western singer, had been Alan Symes. He had come all the way from Phoenix to die in desperation. If what you say is right, she said to Steve, and Trajan must have gotten more of the mining people later on. I didn't count. I was too scared to even think of counting them. But there couldn't have been more than seven when I was there. I froze. I might even have blacked out for a little while. I can't say for sure. Then I heard gunshots. No question what they were that time. And someone screaming. Then there were more gunshots and the screaming stopped. She went back to her car. Not running, she said she was afraid that panic would take her over if she started running, and then drove into town. She intended to report what she'd found to Jim Reed, or, if Jim was out on county business, as he often was, to one of his deputies, Entragian or Pearson. I didn't run to the car, and I didn't go speeding into town, but I was in shock just the same. I remember feeling around in the glove compartment for my cigarettes, even though I haven't smoked in 5 years. Then I saw two people go running through the intersection. You know, under the blinker light? They nodded. The town's new police car came roaring through right after them. Entragian was driving it, but I didn't know that then. There were three or four gunshots, and the people he was chasing were thrown onto the sidewalk, one right by the grocery store, the other just past it. There was blood. A lot. He never slowed, just went on through the intersection, heading west, and pretty soon I heard more shots. I'm pretty sure I heard him yelling, "Yeehaw," too. I wanted to help the people he'd shot if I could. I drove up a little way, parked, and got out of my car. That's probably what saved my life, getting out of my car. Because everything that moved, Entragian killed it. Anyone. Anything. Everything. There were cars and trucks sitting dead in the street like toys, all zigzagged here and there, at least a dozen of them. There was an El Camino truck turned on its side up by the hardware store. Tommy Ortega's, I think. That truck was almost his girlfriend. I didn't see anything like that, Johnny said. The street was clear when he brought me in. Yeah, the son of a bitch keeps his room picked up. You have to give him that. He didn't want anyone wandering into town and wondering what had happened. That's what I think. He hasn't done much more than sweep the mess under the rug, but it'll hold for a while, especially with this goddamn storm. Which wasn't forecast, Steve said thoughtfully. Right, which wasn't forecast. What happened then? David asked. I ran up to the people he shot. One of them was Evelyn Schoenstack, the lady who runs the Cut and Curl and works part-time in the library. She was dead with her brains all over the sidewalk. Mary winced. Audrey saw it and turned toward her. That's something else you need to remember. If he can see you and he decides to shoot you, you're gone. She passed her eyes over the rest of them, apparently wanting to be sure they didn't think she was joking or exaggerating. He's a dead shot. Accent on the dead. We'll keep it in mind, Steve said. The other one was a delivery guy. He was wearing a pasty cake uniform. Entragian got him in the head, too, but he was still alive. She spoke with a calm Johnny recognized. He had seen it in Vietnam, in the aftermath of half a dozen firefights. He had seen it as a non-combatant, of course, notebook in one hand, pen in the other, ewer tape recorder slung over his shoulder on a strap with a peace sign pinned to it. watching and listening and taking notes and feeling like an outsider, feeling jealous. The bitter thoughts which had crossed his mind then, eunuch in the harem, piano player in the whorehouse, now struck him as insane. The year I was 12, my old man gave me a 22, Audrey Weiler said. The first thing I did was go outside our house in Sedalia and shoot a jay. When I went over to it, it was still alive, too. It was trembling all over, staring straight ahead, and its beak was opening and closing, very slowly. I've never in my whole life wanted so badly to take something back. I got down on my knees beside it and waited for it to be finished. It seemed that I owed it that much. It just went on trembling all over until it died. The Tasty Cake Man was trembling like that. He was looking down the street past me, although there wasn't anybody there, and his forehead was covered with tiny beads of sweat. His head was all pushed out of shape, and there was white stuff on his shoulder. I had this crazy idea at first that it was styrofoam poppers. You know, the packing stuff people put in the box when they mail something fragile. And then I saw it was bone chips from his, you know, his skull. I don't want to hear any more of this, Ralph said abruptly. I don't blame you, Johnny said, but I think we need to know. Why don't you and your boy take a little walk around backstage, see what you can find? Ralph nodded, stood up, and took a step toward David. No, David said. We have to stay. Ralph looked at him uncertainly. David nodded. I'm sorry, but we do, he said. Ralph stood where he was a moment longer, then sat down again. During this exchange, Johnny happened to look over at Audrey. She was staring at the boy with an expression that could have been fear or awe or both, as if she had never seen a creature quite like him. Then he thought of the crackers coming out of that bag like clowns out of the little car at the circus, and he wondered if any of them had ever seen a creature quite like David Carver. He thought of the transmission bars, and Billingsley saying not even Houdini could have done it, because of the head. They were concentrating on the buzzards and the spiders and the coyotes, on rats that jumped out of stacks of tires and houses that might be full of rattlesnakes. Most of all, they were concentrating on Antragian, who spoke in tongues and shot like Buffalo Bill. But what about David? Just what exactly was he? Go on, Audrey, Cynthia said, only maybe you could, you know, drop back from R to PG-13. She lifted her chin in David's direction. Audrey looked at her vaguely for a moment, not seeming to understand. Then she gathered herself and continued. 2. I was kneeling there by the delivery guy, trying to think what I should do next, stay with him or run and call someone, when there were more screams and gunshots up on Cotton Street. Glass broke. There was a splintering sound, wood, and then a big clanging, banging sound, metal. The cruiser started to rev again. It seems like that's all I've heard for 2 days, that cruiser revving. He peeled out, and then I could hear him coming my way. I only had a second to think, but I don't guess I would have done anything different, even if I'd had longer. I ran. I wanted to get back to my car and drive away, but I didn't think there was time. I didn't think there was even time to get back around the corner and out of sight. So I went into the grocery store, Worrell's. Wendy Worrell was lying dead by the cash register. Her dad, he's the butcher as well as the owner, was sitting in the little office area, shot in the head. His shirt was off. He must have been just changing into his whites when it happened. "You starts work early," Billingsley said, "lots earlier than the rest of his family." "Oh, but Antragian keeps coming back and checking," Audrey said. Her voice was light, conversational, hysterical. "That's what makes him so dangerous. He keeps coming back and checking. He's crazy, and he has no mercy, but he's also methodical." "He's one sick puppy, though," Johnny said. "When he brought me into town, he was on the verge of bleeding out, and that was 6 hours ago. If whatever's happening to him hasn't slowed down..." He shrugged. "Don't let him trick you," she almost whispered. Johnny understood what she was suggesting, knew from what he had seen with his own eyes that it was impossible, knew also that telling her so would be a waste of breath. "Go on," Steve said. "What then?" "I tried to use the phone in Mr. Worrell's office. It was dead. I stayed in the back of the store for about half an hour. The cruiser went by twice during that time, once on Main Street, then around the back, probably on Mesquite or Cotton again. There were more gunshots. I went upstairs to where the Worrells live, thinking maybe the phone up there would still be live. It wasn't. Neither was Mrs. Worrell or the boy. Mert, I think his name was. She was in the kitchen with her head in the sink and her throat cut. He was still in bed. The blood was everywhere. I stood in his doorway, looking in at his posters of rock musicians and basketball players, and outside I could hear the cruiser going by again, fast, accelerating. I went down the back way, but I didn't dare open the back door once I got there. I kept imagining him crouched down below the porch, waiting for me. I mean, I just heard him go by, but I still kept imagining him waiting for me. I decided the best thing I could do was wait for dark. Then I could drive away. Maybe. You couldn't be sure, because he was just so unpredictable. He wasn't always on Main Street, and you couldn't always hear him, and you'd start thinking, well, maybe he's gone, headed for the hills, and then he'd be back, like a damn rabbit coming out of a magician's hat. But I couldn't stay in the store. The sound of the flies was driving me crazy, for one thing, and it was hot. I don't usually mind the heat. You can't mind it if you live in central Nevada, but I kept thinking I smelled them. So I waited until I heard him shooting somewhere over by the town garage. That's on Dumont Street, about as far east as you can go before you run out of town. And then I left. Stepping out of the market and back onto the sidewalk was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life, like being a soldier and stepping out into no man's land. At first, I couldn't move at all. I just froze right where I was. I remember thinking that I had to walk. I couldn't run because I'd panic if I did, but I had to walk. Except I couldn't. Couldn't! It was like being paralyzed. Then I heard him coming back. It was weird, as if he sensed me. Sensed someone, anyway, moving around while his back was turned. Like he was playing a new kind of kids' game, one where you get to murder the losers instead of just sending them back to prisoner's base or something. The engine, it's so loud when it starts to rev. So powerful. So loud. Even when I'm not hearing it, I'm imagining I hear it. You know? It sounds like a catamount getting like a wildcat in heat. That's what I heard coming toward me, and still I couldn't move. I could only stand there and listen to it getting closer. I thought about the Tasty Cake Man, how he was shivering like the jay I shot when I was a kid, and that finally got me going. I went into the laundromat and threw myself down on the floor just as he went by. I heard more screaming north of town, but I don't know what that was about because I couldn't look up. I couldn't get up. I must have lain there on that floor for almost 20 minutes. That's how bad I was. I can say I was way beyond scared by then, but I can't make you understand how weird it gets in your head when you're that way. I lay there on the floor, looking at the dust balls and mashed-up cigarette butts, and thinking how you could tell this was a laundromat even down at the level I was, because of the smell, and because all the butts had lipstick on them. I lay there, and I couldn't have moved even if I'd heard him coming up the sidewalk. I would have lain there until he put the barrel of his gun on the side of my head and... "Don't," Mary said, wincing. "Don't talk about it." "But I can't stop thinking about it," she shouted, and something about that jagged on Johnny Marinville's ear as nothing else she'd said had. She made a visible effort to get herself under control, then went on. What got me past that was the sound of people outside. I got up on my knees and crawled over to the door. I saw 4 people across the street by the owls. 2 were Mexican, the Escoya boy who works on the crusher up at the mine, and his girlfriend. I don't know her name, but she's got a blonde streak in her hair. Natural, I'm almost sure, and she's awfully pretty. Was awfully pretty. There was another woman, quite heavy. I'd never seen her before. The man with her I've seen playing pool with you and Buds, Tom. Flip somebody.
Flip Moran? You saw the flipper?
She nodded. They were working their way up the other side of the street, trying cars, looking for keys. I thought about mine and how we could all go together. I started to get up. They were passing that little alley over there, the one between the storefront where the Italian restaurant used to be and the broken drum, and Antragian came roaring right out of the alley in his cruiser, like he'd been waiting for them. Probably he was waiting for them. He hit them all, but I think your friend Flip was the only one killed outright. The others just went skidding off to one side, like bowling pins when you miss a good hit. They kind of grabbed each other to keep from falling down. Then they ran. The Escoya boy had his arm around his girlfriend. She was crying and holding her arm against her breasts. It was broken. You could see it was. It looked like it had an extra joint in it above the elbow. The other woman had blood pouring down her face. When she heard Antragian coming after them, that big, powerful engine, she spun around and held her hands up like she was a crossing guard or something. He was driving with his right hand and leaning out the window like a locomotive engineer. He shot her twice before he hit her with the car and ran her under. That was the first really good look I got at him, the first time I knew for sure who I was dealing with. She looked at them one by one, as if trying to measure the effect her words were having. He was grinning. Grinning and laughing like a kid on his first visit to Disney World. Happy, you know? Happy. 3. Audrey had crouched there at the laundromat door, watching Antragian chase the Escoya boy and his girl north on Main Street with the cruiser. He caught them and ran them down as he had the older woman. It was easy to get them both at once, she said, because the boy was trying to help the girl. The two of them were running together. When they were down, Antragian had stopped, backed up, backed slowly over them. There had been no wind then, Audrey told them, and she had heard the sound of their bones snapping very clearly. Got out, walked over to them, knelt between them, put a bullet in the back of the girl's head, then took off the Escoya boy's hat, which had stayed on through everything, and put a bullet in the back of his head. Then he put the hat back on him again, Audrey said. If I live through this, that's one thing I'll never forget, no matter how long I live. How he took the boy's hat off to shoot him, then put it back on again. It was as if he was saying he understood how hard this was on them, and he wanted to be as considerate as possible. Antragian stood up, turned in a circle, reloading as he did, seeming to look everywhere at once. Audrey said he was wearing a big, goony smile. Johnny knew the kind she meant. He had seen it. In a crazy way, it seemed to him he had seen all of this, in a dream or another life. "It's just dem old cosmic Vietnam blues again," he told himself. The way she described the cop reminded him of certain stone troopers he had run with, and certain stories he had been told late at night. Whispered tales from grunts who had seen guys, their own guys, do terrible, unspeakable things with that same look of immaculate good cheer on their faces. "It's Vietnam, that's all, coming at you like an acid flashback. All you need now to complete the circle is a transistor radio sticking out of someone's pocket, playing People Are Strange, or Pictures of Matchstick Men." But was that all? A deeper part of him seemed to doubt the idea. That part thought something else was going on here, something which had little or nothing to do with the paltry memories of a novelist who had fed on war like a buzzard on carrion, and had subsequently produced exactly the sort of bad book such behavior probably warranted. "All right, then. If it's not you, what is it?" "What did you do then?" Steve asked her. "Went back to the laundromat office. I crawled, and when I got there, I crawled into the knee hole under the desk and curled up in there and went to sleep. I was very tired. Seeing all those things, all that death. It made me very tired. It was thin sleep. I kept hearing things. Gunshots, explosions, breaking glass, screams. I have no idea how much of it was real and how much was just in my mind. When I woke up, it was late afternoon. I was sore all over. At first, I thought it had all been a dream, that I might even still be camping. Then I opened my eyes and saw where I was, curled up under a desk, and I smelled bleach and laundry soap, and realized I had to pee worse than ever in my life. Also, both of my legs were asleep. I started wiggling out from under the desk, telling myself not to panic if I got a little stuck, and that was when I heard somebody come into the front of the store, and I yanked myself back under the desk again. It was him. I knew it just by the way he walked. It was the sound of a man in boots. He goes, "Is anyone here?" and came up the aisle between the washers and dryers, like he was following my tracks. In a way, he was. It was my perfume. I hardly ever wear it, but putting on a dress made me think of it, made me think it might make things go a little smoother at my meeting with Mr. Symes. She shrugged, maybe a little embarrassed. You know what they say about using the tools. Cynthia looked blank at this, but Mary nodded. "It smells like opium," he says. "Is it, miss? Is that what you're wearing?" I didn't say anything, just curled up there in the knee hole with my arms wrapped around my head. He goes, "Why don't you come out? If you come out, I'll make it quick. If I have to find you, I'll make it slow." And I wanted to come out. That's how much he'd gotten to me, how much he'd scared me. I believed he knew for sure that I was still in there somewhere, and that he was going to follow the smell of my perfume to me like a bloodhound, and I wanted to get out from under the desk and go to him so he'd kill me quick. I wanted to go to him the way the people in Jonestown must have wanted to stand in line to get the Kool-Aid. Only I couldn't. I froze up again, and all I could do was lie there and think that I was going to die needing to pee. I saw the office chair. I'd pulled it out so I could get into the knee hole of the desk, and I thought, when he sees where the chair is, he'll know where I am. That was when he came into the office, while I was thinking that. "Is someone in here?" he goes. "Come on out. I won't hurt you. I just want to question you about what's going on. We've got a big problem." Audrey began to tremble, as Johnny supposed she had trembled while she had been hedgehogged in the knee hole of the desk, waiting for Entragian to come the rest of the way into the room, find her, and kill her. Except she was smiling, too, the kind of smile you could hardly bring yourself to look at. That's how crazy he was. She clasped her shaking hands together in her lap. In one breath, he says that if you come out, he'll reward you by killing you quick. In the next, he says he just wants to ask you a few questions. Crazy. But I believed both things at once. So who's the craziest one, huh? Who's the craziest one? He came a couple of steps into the room. I think it was a couple. Far enough for his shadow to fall over the desk and onto the other side, where I was. I remember thinking that if his shadow had eyes, they'd be able to see me. He stood there for a long time. I could hear him breathing. Then he said, "Fuck it," and left. A minute or so later, I heard the street door open and close. At first, I was sure it was a trick. In my mind's eye, I could see him just as clearly as I can see you guys now, opening the door and then closing it again, but still standing there on the inside, next to the machine with the little packets of soap in it, standing there with his gun out, waiting for me to move. And you know what? I went on thinking that even after he started roaring around the streets in his car again, looking for other people to murder. I think I'd be under there still, except I knew that if I didn't go to the bathroom, I was going to wet my pants, and I didn't want to do that. No way. If he was able to smell my perfume, he'd smell fresh urine even quicker. So I crawled out and went to the bathroom. I hobbled like an old lady because my legs were still asleep. But I got there. And although she spoke for another 10 minutes or so, Johnny thought that was where Audrey Weiler's story essentially ended, with her hobbling into the office bathroom to take a leak. Her car was close by, and she had the keys in her dress pocket, but it might as well have been on the moon instead of Main Street for all the good it was to her. She'd gone back and forth several times between the office and the laundromat proper. Johnny didn't doubt for a moment the courage it must have taken to move around even that much. But she had gone no further. Her nerve wasn't just shot, it was shattered. When the gunshots and the maddening, ceaselessly revving engine stopped for a while, she would think about making a break for it, she said, but then she would imagine Antragian catching up to her, running her off the road, pulling her out of her car, and shooting her in the head. Also, she told them, she had been convinced that help would arrive, had to. Desperation was off the main road, yes, sure, but not that far off, and with the mine getting ready to reopen, people were always coming and going. Some people had come into town, she said. She had seen a Federal Express panel truck around 5 that afternoon, and a Wyckoff County Light and Power pickup around noon of the next day, yesterday. Both went by on Main Street. She had heard music coming from the pickup. She didn't hear Antragian's cruiser that time, but 5 minutes or so after the pickup passed the laundromat, there were more gunshots, and a man screaming, "Oh, don't! Oh, don't!" in a voice so high it could have been a girl's. After that, another endless night, not wanting to stay, not quite daring to try and make a break for it, eating snacks from the machine that stood at the end of the dryers, drinking water from the basin in the bathroom. Then a new day, with Antragian still circling like a vulture. She hadn't been aware, she said, that he was bringing people into town and jugging them. By then, all she'd been able to think about were plans for getting away, none of them seeming quite good enough. And in a way, the laundromat had begun to feel like home, to feel safe. Antragian had been in here once, had left, and hadn't returned. He might never return. I hung on to the idea that he couldn't have gotten everyone, that there had to be others like me who saw what was going on in time to get their heads down. Some would get out. They'd call the state police. I kept telling myself it was wiser, at least for the time being, to wait. Then the storm came, and I decided to try to use it for cover. I'd sneak back to the mining office. There's an ATV in the garage of the hideaway. Steve nodded. We saw it. Got a little cart filled with rock samples behind it. My idea was to unhook the gondola and drive northwest back to Highway 50. I could grab a compass out of a supply cabinet, so even in the blow I'd be okay. Of course I knew I might go falling into a crevasse or something, but that didn't seem like much of a risk, not after what I'd seen. And I had to get out. 2 nights in a laundromat. Hey, you try it. I was getting ready to do it when you two came along. I damn near brained you, Steve said. Sorry about that. She smiled wanly, then looked around once more. And the rest you know, she said. I don't agree, Johnny Merrinville thought. The throb in his nose was increasing again. He wanted a drink, and badly. Since that would be madness, for him anyway, he pulled the bottle of aspirin out of his pocket and took 2 with a sip of spring water. I don't think we know anything. Not yet, anyway. 4. Mary Jackson said, "What do we do now? How do we get out of this mess? Do we even try, or do we wait to be rescued?" For a long time, no one replied. Then Steve shifted in the chair he was sharing with Cynthia and said, "We can't wait. Not for long, anyway." "Why do you say that?" Johnny asked. His voice was curiously gentle, as if he already knew the answer to this question. "Because somebody should have gotten away, gotten to a phone outside of town and pulled the plug on the murder machine. No one did, though. Even before the storm started, no one did. Something very powerful's happening here, and I think that counting on help from the outside may only get us killed. We have to count on each other, and we have to get out as soon as possible. That's what I believe. I'm not going without finding out what happened to my mom, David said.
You can't think that way, son, Johnny said.
Yes, I can. I am.
No, Billingsley said.
Something in his voice made David raise his head.
Not with other lives at stake. Not when you're special the way you are. We need you, son.
That's not fair, David almost whispered.
No, Billingsley agreed. His lined face was stony. It ain't.
Cynthia said, It won't do your mother any good if you, and the rest of us, die trying to find her, kiddo. On the other hand, if we can get out of town, we could come back with help.
Right, Ralph said, but he said it in a hollow, sick way.
No, it's not right, David said. It's a crock of shit, that's what it is.
David!
The boy surveyed them, his face fierce with anger and sick with fright. None of you care about my mother, not one of you. Even you don't, Dad.
That's untrue, Ralph said, and it's a cruel thing to say.
Yeah, David said, but I think it's true just the same. I know you love her, but I think you'd leave her because you believe she's already dead. He fixed his father with his gaze, and when Ralph looked down at his hands, tears oozing out of his swollen eye, David switched to the veterinarian.
And I'll tell you something, Mr. Billingsley. Just because I pray doesn't mean I'm a comic book wizard or something. Praying's not magic. The only magic I know is a couple of card tricks that I usually mess up on anyway.
David, Steve began,
if we go away and come back, it'll be too late to save her. I know it will be. I know that.
His words rang from the stage like an actor's speech, then died away. Outside, the indifferent wind gusted.
David, it's probably already too late, Johnny said.
His voice was steady enough, but he couldn't quite look at the kid as he said it. Ralph sighed harshly. His son went to him, sat beside him, took his hand. Ralph's face was drawn with weariness and confusion. He looked older now.
Steve turned to Audrey. You said you knew another way out.
Yes. The big earthwork you see as you come into town is the north face of the pit we've reopened. There's a road that goes up the side of it, over the top and into the pit. There's another one that goes back to Highway 50 west of here. It runs along Desperation Creek, which is just a dry wash now. You know where I mean, Tom?
He nodded.
That road, Desperation Creek Road, starts at the motor pool. There are more ATVs there. The biggest only seats four safely, but we could hook up an empty gondola, and the other three could ride in it.
Steve, a 10-year veteran of load-ins, load-outs, snap decisions, and rapid getaways, often necessitated by the combination of four-star hotels and rock band assholes, had been following her carefully.
Okay, what I suggest is this. We wait until morning. Get some rest, maybe even a little sleep. The storm might blow itself out by then.
I think the wind has let up a little, Mary said. Maybe that's wishful thinking, but I really think it has.
Even if it's still going, we can get up to the motor pool, can't we, Audrey?
I'm sure we can.
How far is it?
2 miles from the mining office, probably a mile and a half from here.
He nodded. And in daylight, we'll be able to see Entragian. If we try to go at night, in the storm, we can't count on that.
We can't count on being able to see the wildlife either, Cynthia said.
I'm talking about moving fast and armed, Steve said. If the storm plays out, we can head up to the embankment in my truck. 3 up front in the cab with me, 4 back in the box. If the weather is still bad, and I actually hope it will be, I think we should go on foot. We'll attract less attention that way. He might never even know we're gone.
I imagine the Escoya boy and his friends were thinking about the same way when Collie ran him down, Billingsley said.
They were headed north on Main Street, Johnny said. Exactly what Entragian would have been looking for. We'll be going south, toward the mine, at least initially, and leaving the area on a feeder road.
Yeah, Steve said. And then, bang, we're gone.
He went over to David. The boy had left his father and was sitting on the edge of the stage, staring out over the tacky old theater seats, and squatted beside him.
But we'll come back. You hear me, David? We'll come back for your mom and for anyone else he's left alive. That's a rock-solid promise from me to you.
David went on staring out over the seats.
I don't know what to do, he said. I know I need to ask God to help me straighten out my head, but right now I'm so mad at him that I can't. Every time I try to compose my mind, that gets in the way. He let the cop take my mother. Why? Jesus, why?
Do you know you did a miracle just a little while ago? Steve thought.
He didn't say it. It might only make David's confusion and misery worse. After a moment, Steve got up and stood looking down at the boy, hands shoved deep into his pockets, eyes troubled.
5.
The cougar walked slowly down the alley, head lowered, ears flattened. She avoided the garbage cans and the pile of scrap lumber much more easily than the humans had done. She saw far better in the dark. Still, she paused at the end of the alley, a low, squalling growl rising from her throat. She didn't like this. One of them was strong, very strong. She could sense that one's force, even through the brick flank of the building, pulsing like a glow. Still, there was no question of disobedience. The outsider, the one from the earth, was in the cougar's head, its will caught in her mind like a fishhook. That one spoke in the language of the unformed, from the time before, when all animals except for men and the outsider were one. But she didn't like that sense of force, that glow. She growled again, a rasp that rose and fell, coming more from her nostrils than her closed mouth. She slipped her head around the corner, wincing at a blast of wind that ruffled her fur and charged her nose with smells of brome grass and Indian paintbrush and old booze and older brick. Even from here she could smell the bitterness from the pit south of town, the smell that had been there since they had charged the last half-dozen blast holes and reopened the bad place, the one the animals knew about and the men had tried to forget. The wind died, and the cougar padded slowly down the path between the board fence and the rear of the theater. She stopped to sniff at the crates, spending more time on the one which had been overturned than on the one which still stood against the wall. There were many intermingled scents here. The last person who had stood on the overturned crate had then pushed it off the one still against the wall. The cougar could smell his hands, a different, sharper smell than the others. A skin smell, undressed somehow, tangy with sweat and oils. It belonged to a male in the prime of his life. She could also smell guns. Under other circumstances, that smell would have sent her running, but now it didn't matter. She would go where the old one sent her. She had no choice. The cougar sniffed the wall, then looked up at the window. It was unlocked. She could see it moving back and forth in the wind. Not much, because it was recessed, but enough for her to be sure it was open. She could get inside. It would be easy. The window would push in before her, giving way as man-things sometimes did.
No, the voice of the unformed said. You can't.
An image flickered briefly in her mind. Shiny things. Man-drinkers, sometimes smashed to bright fragments on the rocks when the men were done with them. She understood, in the way that a layperson may vaguely understand a complicated geometry proof if it is carefully explained, that she would knock a number of these man-drinkers onto the floor if she tried to jump through the window. She didn't know how that could be, but the voice in her head said it was, and that the others would hear them break. The cougar passed beneath the unlatched window like a dark eddy, paused to sniff at the fire door, which had been boarded shut, then came to a second window, This one was the same height as the one with the man-drinkers inside of it, and made of the same white glass, but it wasn't unlatched. "It's the one you'll use, though," the voice in the cougar's head whispered. "When I tell you it's time, that's the one you'll use."
Yes, she might cut herself on the glass in the window, as she had once cut the pads of her feet on the pieces of man-drinkers up in the hills. But when the voice in her head told her that the time had come, she would jump at the window. Once inside, she would continue to do what the voice told her. It wasn't the way things were supposed to be, but for now, it was the way things were. The cougar lay below the bolted men's room window, curled her tail around her, and waited for the voice of the thing from the pit, the voice of the outsider, the voice of Tack. When it came, she would move. Until it did, she would lie here and listen to the voice of the wind and smell the bitterness it brought with it, like bad news from another world.
Chapter 3 1 Mary watched the old veterinarian take a bottle of whiskey out of the liquor cabinet, almost drop it, then pour himself a drink. She took a step toward Johnny and spoke to him in a low voice. "Make him stop. That's the one with the drunk in it." He looked at her with raised eyebrows. "Who elected you temperance queen?" "You shithead," she hissed. "Don't you think I know who got him started? Don't you think I saw?" She started toward Tom, but Johnny pulled her back and went himself. He heard her little gasp of pain and supposed he might have squeezed her wrist a little harder than was exactly gentlemanly. Well, he wasn't used to being called a shithead. He had won a National Book Award, after all. He had been on the cover of Time. He had also fucked America's sweetheart. Well, maybe that was sort of retroactive or something. She hadn't really been America's sweetheart since 1965 or so, but he had still fucked her. And he wasn't used to being called a shithead. Yet Mary had a point. He, a man not unacquainted with the highways and byways of Alcoholics Anonymous, had nevertheless given that kiddie favorite, Mr. Drunken Doggy Doctor, his first shot of the evening. He'd thought it would pull Billingsley together, get him focused, and they had needed him focused. It was his town, after all. But hadn't he also been a teeny tiny bit pissed off at the tosspot vet awarding himself a loaded gun, while the National Book Award kid had to be contented with an unloaded .22? No. No, damn it. The gun wasn't the issue. Keeping the old man wired together enough to be of some help, that was the issue. Well, maybe. Maybe. It felt a little bogus, but you had to give yourself the benefit of the doubt in some situations, especially the crazy ones, which this certainly was. Either way, it maybe hadn't been such a good idea. He had had a large number of not-such-good ideas in his life, and if anyone was qualified to recognize one when he saw it, John Edward Merrinville was probably that fellow. "Why don't we save that for later, Tom?" he said, and smoothly plucked the glass of whiskey out of the vet's hand just as he was bringing it to his lips. "Hey!" Billingsley cawed, making a swipe at it. His eyes were more watery than ever, and now threaded with bright red stitches that looked like tiny cuts. "Gimme that!" Johnny held it away from him, up by his own mouth, and felt a sudden, appallingly strong urge to take care of the problem in the quickest, simplest way. Instead, he put the glass on top of the bar, where old Tommy wouldn't be able to reach it unless he jumped around to one side or the other. Not that he didn't think Tommy was capable of jumping for a drink. Old Tommy had gotten to the point where he would probably try to fart the marine hymn if someone promised him a double. Meantime, the others were watching, Mary rubbing her wrist, which was red, he observed, but just a little, really no big deal. "Gimme!" Billingsley bawled, and stretched out one hand toward the glass on top of the bar, opening and closing his fingers like an angry baby that wants its sucker back. Johnny suddenly remembered how the actress, The one with the emeralds, the one who had been America's number one honey bunny in days of yore, so sweet sugar wouldn't melt in her snatch, had once pushed him into the pool at the Bel Air,